This is
Make It Kind.
M.I.P.
with Masamela Matfumo.
Mark Thompson.
Make It Kind.
Get woke.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're happy to have back with us on the show. Those of you who have been a part of Make It Plain over the years know my guest as no stranger. And but things are a little bit different now. We have talked about some of his scholarly articles. The last time we spoke, he did mention, and that might have been before the pandemic even, Professor. The last time we spoke, he mentioned he was working on this piece of scholarship, going into a book, and that has happened. So we congratulate him on that. Just out at the end of March, the book Madison's Militia, The Hidden History of the Second Amendment. We welcome back Professor of Law, soon to be Professor of Law Emeritus at Roger Williams University, Professor Carl T. Bogus. Professor Bogus, how are you?
I'm great, Reverend Mark. Thank you for having me back.
It is. It's a pleasure to have you back. It's wonderful to have you. I want to begin this way in that, you know, we're seeing really an epidemic of mass shootings and gun violence every day, everywhere. There's always a story in the news. I've said this aloud. I want to share with you what I've shared and get your reaction to it and using your research. I say to people, I wonder if those who advocate for AR-15s, advocate for the Second Amendment, those who don't, who only want to apply thoughts and prayers when these types of mass shootings happen, Professor, I say to myself, I wonder, and even in Nashville, I was in Nashville during the Tennessee Three and the Covenant shooting. I'll be back in Nashville next week. And I've asked, I wonder how those who advocate for the Second Amendment and who watch our young people die every day, I wonder how they would feel if they actually knew and understood that we are losing lives today because of an amendment that wasn't meant for everyone to have an individual right, but rather an amendment that was meant to stop my enslaved ancestors from insurrection. I mean, that's what people are dying for. And I've asked that question. What do you think about my take on it? He's a professor. I always like to ask questions as a student so he can critique me. But what do you think about that?
I think I agree with your take on this, which is people have this image that the Second Amendment was some sacred bequest from the founders that has something to do with freedom and liberty. And I think that if there's an image that people associate it with, it's the musket in the hands of the Minutemen at Lexington and Concord. And somehow it's resisting tyranny. It's somehow vaguely associated with liberty. If they realized that the amendment had nothing to do with freedom, it had to do largely with exactly the reverse, slavery, they'd have a different attitude to the Second Amendment. So the Second Amendment a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, was all about keeping an armed militia in order to prevent rebellions and insurrection, and the insurrection that the principal author of the Second Amendment, James Madison, was concerned with principally with slave insurrection.
You, in this climate too, ladies and gentlemen, the other reason the book is important, and he is a law professor, but this is a history book. He discloses that in the introduction, much to his credit. In this climate of history being, a resistance to history being taught in many schools, particularly history of our history, African-American history, excellent research in the book about our enslaved ancestors' insurrections. We don't know about that a lot. That's not taught. There's still sort of this image of docility. But you go into great detail, and if you could encapsulate that for us, Professor, just how prevalent insurrections were and how terrified the colonists were of insurrections.
The myth that was perpetrated by slave owners themselves back in the day was that slaves in the American South were happy, content, and docile. That was the myth. And a fellow named Herbert Aplecker wrote a book, was actually a doctoral thesis at Columbia, in which, this was in the 1940s, in which he identified 250 slave revolts or slave conspiracies that hadn't yet ripened into a full revolt but was extinguished, or rumors of slave revolts. And that shattered that myth, the fact that somebody was able to identify through largely newspaper accounts at the time, 250 either actual revolts or potential revolts. And that changed everything, and historians looked more deeply into slavery, and slaves were anything but happy, content, and docile. The largest slave revolt prior to the writing of the Second Amendment, and that's what I focus on, what did James Madison and the First Congress have in their minds when they wrote the Second Amendment? The largest one took place in 1739 in Stono, South Carolina, where somewhere between 60 and 100 slaves broke into a store, killed the white men in there, seized the weapons and the ammunition, and began to march down the road and invade plantations and invade and kill the owners of the plantations. That rebellion was extinguished in a battle with the militia by the end of that day. But that terrified the South. They realized that slaves could collaborate in a revolt, and that they could be determined enough to revolt, knowing that they'd be killed. They weren't going to get away with it. They would be killed, but they would die free. and that slaves were disgruntled enough and determined enough to do that. In the Caribbean, there were a series of slave revolts, and I talk particularly about the one in Jamaica, that the British colonists and the British Navy could not extinguish, and actually had to make a deal with the slaves that they could set up communities in the jungle and in the hills, because they really were not able to put down an insurrection, and the slaves almost took all of Jamaica.
Yeah.
Later on they did take all of Haiti, but slaves engaged in many different acts of rebellion, including poisoning their masters and splitting their throat in the night, presumably. So the fact of the matter is that the South lived under constant terror of slave revolt in many areas, including Eastern Virginia, where James Madison, George Mason, George Washington lived. Slaves constituted a majority of the population. So you had a white minority attempting to control an enslaved black majority, and the principal instrument of control was the militia, which they believed needed to be armed.
You chronicle, and folks, again, we don't know this, but they knew it back then. Professor Bogus writes, historians have, and he mentions the Aptheker book. I would encourage people to check that out as well, American Negro Slave Revolts. But just before that, he writes this, Professor Bogus, historians have identified 579 rebellions or attacks on slave ships or auxiliary boats, with almost 80% occurring between 1726 and 1800. These revolts were getting a lot of attention during James Madison's day. In fact, newspapers then were frequently publishing stories about shipboard revolts during the 1760s and 1770s. You also, now just to kind of set this context too, I believe, I'm going to go back and find the quote, but I'll ask you the question. I believe Patrick Henry was also quoted as talking about, in your book, just how close the enslaved population was to the white population. In Virginia, in specific, so you had, let's say, and I'm want to pull it up. I don't have the exact number, but I think he was quoted as by you as saying that there were approximately 300 some odd thousand white Virginians to over 250,000 some odd enslaved people. So that wasn't comforting either, because folks, they were enslaving our ancestors almost to an equal number. So it was no, if there was going to be a revolt, it was not going to be a small thing.
Well, they were certainly terrified of a large scale revolt, and they had seen it in the Caribbean. They had seen the potential for it in Stono, South Carolina. And the Stono incident is interesting, particularly because of the relationship between the militia and slave control. So shortly before that revolt occurred, South Carolina enacted a law that required militiamen to carry weapons, muskets, with them to church on Sunday. And the reason for that was they were worried that when people went to church and they were not on the plantation, that that might be an opportune time for slave revolt. And they wanted white men armed. And what happened when the Stonewall Rebellion occurred, really by chance, the lieutenant governor of South Carolina was riding along and saw you know, up to 100 slaves with banners that said liberty and beating on drums and calling on other slaves and plantations to join them, saw that, of course, was incredibly alarmed and went to local church, and who was there but armed white men. And they went to other churches and collected the militia. And so the armed militia was able to assemble incredibly quickly and meet the growing rebellion quickly in battle and defeat the rebels. It was costly on both sides. About 60 militiamen and slave owners were killed by the end of the day. Of course, the slaves were put to death. Those that were not defeated in the battle and escaped were hunted down and killed, either back on their plantations or elsewhere. But the incident tells us something about not only the potential of slave revolt, but the control system, the reliance on the militia to, first of all, deter slave revolts through slave patrols every night, and also being ready to extinguish revolts if they occur.
I found a quote. It was actually not Patrick Henry. It was Edmund Randolph in Virginia. I think he might have been the governor or something.
He was then the governor.
Listen to this, folks. There's another circumstance that renders us more vulnerable. He's talking about Virginians back then. Are we not weakened by the population of those we hold in slavery? The day may come when they may make impression upon us. Gentlemen who have been long accustomed to the contemplation of the subject think there is a cause of alarm in this case. The number of people compared to that of whites is an immense proportion. Their number, meaning the enslaved, amounts to 236,000, that of whites only to 352,000. Again, speaking to the irrationality of the institution, you're going to bring in as many people as you have a population and then try to keep them down. Duh. But Professor Bogus, here's the million-dollar question. I know many are watching and listening, so wait a minute now. Is that really what the militia was for? Not only is the presumption the Second Amendment was for an individual right to keep and bear arms. That's what the Supreme Court decided in Heller, which was false. There's also this mythical fantasy story that it was to be ever ready for an invasion of another country because of what the militia had done so successfully during the Revolutionary War. That is not the case at all. And you also chronicle very thoroughly how ineffective the militia was. So ineffective, there was really no way during the debates anybody could make a credible argument that, you know, we need a militia for this other reason, to act as if it is as effective as the Continental Army. It was not.
So the militia proved to be a complete bust during the Revolutionary War. I think people aren't aware of that. The only real militia victories were Lexington and Concord. And you could count Bunker Hill, depending upon whether you count a victory based on fatalities inflicted or ground held. But after that, the militia achieved nothing. And in fact, in battle, I'm not going to say more often than not, because militia did in the North at times stand their ground, but very often militia threw down their weapons and fled without firing a single shot. That happened in Battle of Camden in South Carolina, where Virginia and I think North Carolina militia themselves outnumbering the British forces, but supported by a large contingent of Continental Army, when they saw the British advancing on them, threw their weapons and their equipment away without firing a single shot and fled, to the great disgrace of their commander, who wrote a letter to Thomas Jefferson saying, I recognize militia will not do. And it actually became Continental Army doctrine in the South with militia forces to have kind of a carrot and a stick to encourage them to fire maybe one or two shots before leaving the battlefield. General Daniel Morgan came up with is he said to the militia, look, I'm going to put you in the front. I'm going to ask you to just fire one or two shots as the British advance, and then do an orderly withdrawal behind the Continental troops. And if you only fire one or two, we're happy with you. Just do an orderly withdrawal. Because in Camden, when they fled, they actually knocked over Continental troops as they raced through their ranks of the Continental troops. That worked to a minor degree. Some militia did fire two shots. Some fired one shot. Maybe some fired none. When Daniel Morgan discussed this with his commander, Nathaniel Green, as Green was about to face battle, he recommended Green that Green surround the militia with Continental forces and order the Continental troops to fire the first militiamen to bolt, that's what was necessary to kind of keep militiamen in place. Green didn't actually do that, but he did do what Morgan did. You can just fire one shot or two shots and do an orderly withdrawal, and the Continental forces will stand their ground. But that was kind of the best of the militia. And it's not that surprising in many ways, because it's rigorous and hard training that turns a human being into a soldier. Being a soldier is not a natural thing. And that's what it is. And that was the difference between the Continental Army or any professional army and a militia. The army was trained over periods of weeks and months, and the militia had almost no training whatsoever.
And then going up against a trained and even more well-trained British army. The army in America was new, as a matter of fact. Patrick Henry, one of the leading spokespersons, he's Virginia, George Mason, all these guys. They also, too, weren't they radicalized by the other reality, too. Lord Dunmore of the British had promised the enslaved freedom if they fought on their side.
Yes.
And some northern states, with the endorsement, I think Rhode Island, maybe that was the only one, I don't know, with the endorsement even of General George Washington, invited the enslaved to join the Continental ranks.
So the
Southern states weren't, and this is before the Civil War, folks, so this is brewing. They weren't excited about any of the enslaved having guns.
Yeah, absolutely not. Guns were complete contraband and prohibited to slaves, whether at war or not at war. And the South invested enormous resources in slave patrols conducted everywhere in the South, except in North Carolina, by the militia, When I say not North Carolina by the militia, of course, it was militia then, even in North Carolina, who were doing the slave patrols, but it wasn't militia officers that were necessarily in charge of it. But in Virginia and South Carolina and Georgia and other areas, the militia were in charge of slave control patrols. And every night, slave patrollers would go out to make sure that slaves where they were supposed to be, that they were not where they were not supposed to be, that they were not going between plantations, that they were staying where they were supposed to be, and conducted searches to ensure they did not have guns, they did not have weapons, they did not have reading material, because they were also prohibited from learning to read. Another way of keeping them powerless. So the militia was essential to deterring revolts, because slaves knew every night the slave patrollers were out, armed in groups. They were necessary as a deterrent, and then if a revolt happened, they were necessary to suppress it. It was, Reverend Mark, a successful system. It did preserve slavery, and they fully understood how essential the militia was to their success as slave owners.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Back to Patrick Henry.
Yes.
He pretty much led the argument for there to be a Second Amendment for this purpose. The man who most famously said, give me liberty, give me death. You also describe him as an orator, an enormous amount of influence and sway he held at the time. But we know him for give me liberty, give me death. We don't know him for saying, we need to keep these guns, y'all, to stop these insurrections.
Yes. So Henry was indisputably the most powerful politician in Virginia at the time. He had been the state's first governor. He was elected governor again later. He was considered to have the power to control the state assembly, the legislature. And the origins of what became the Second Amendment, I believe, occurred in Richmond, Virginia, in June of 1788. And what happened was, a year earlier, the founders had come out of Independence Hall, and they presented a proposed constitution. Supposedly, a woman on the street said, Dr. Benjamin Franklin, Dr. Franklin, what kind of government have you given us? And he said, a republic, if you can keep it. But the constitution required by its own terms that nine states ratify it. at special ratifying conventions. And in June of 1788, Virginia had its ratifying convention. Delegates had to be especially elected. And I think it's one of the most dramatic episodes in American history, and also one of the least known episodes in American history. Someday someone will do a movie about this, because it was an incredibly dramatic showdown. Eight states had ratified, but it did not appear at that time that if Virginia did not ratify, that there was likely to be a ninth state. Rhode Island was absolutely not going to ratify. New York was controlled by an anti-federalist governor, Clinton, and was considered, and people believed would not ratify. And there were problems in both New Hampshire and North Carolina with ratification. So it kind of came down to Virginia. And besides, if Virginia did not ratify and join the Union, could the Union survive? It was the largest state, the most populous state, and it was geographically right in the center. So it was a showdown between the Federalists, who wanted a strong federal government and wanted to ratify, and they were led by James Madison, who knew the Constitution better than anyone else and had been probably the most influential delegate to the Constitutional Convention a year earlier, or certainly one of the most influential. And he was supported by Edmund Randolph, who you mentioned, who was the sitting governor, by Henry Lighthorse, Harry Lee, who was a hero of the Revolutionary War, and by others. And on the other side, the anti-federalists, who feared a strong national government and wanted to preserve the power of Virginia, were led by Patrick Henry, who, as you mentioned, was considered at the time the greatest American orator, and George Mason, who was kind of considered the brains of the anti-federalists, the intellectual of the anti-federalists. And it was quite a showdown between the two of them, between these two groups. And Henry, in many different ways, said, James Madison, you told us you wrote a constitution that does not give the federal government the power to abolish slavery. And we agree with you. You haven't done that. They don't have the power to abolish slavery. There's a encoded slave compact in the Constitution. But here's what you did do. For the first time, you have given the federal government the lion's share of power over the militia. Up until now, the militia have been the creature of state government. The Virginia militia controlled by Virginia. The South Carolina militia controlled by South Carolina. But now you've written a constitution in which Congress, the National Congress, has the power to organize the militia any way it sees fit, to arm the militia, and to create discipline for the militia. That is, the rules and regulations governing the militia. And all we're left with is the power to appoint officers or train the militia in accordance with the discipline established by Congress. By giving the federal government the power to arm the militia, you have also implicitly given them the power to disarm the militia. And they'll do it. They'll do it because abolitionist fever is growing in the North. And you have given them the power to undermine our slave system by disarming our militia. And Madison said, no. Look. The power is concurrent. If the federal government does not disarm, doesn't arm our militia, we can arm our militia. And normally, Madison would not have lost kind of a point of law to Patrick Henry, even though Henry was a lawyer and Madison wasn't, because Madison was brilliant when it came to governmental structure. But Madison wasn't actually particularly healthy at that particular week. And Henry ridiculed him. And you can kind of read the words and imagine the great orator and how he was able to deliver these remarks. And he ridiculed Madison. You got a constitution that says you've doled out explicitly some powers to the federal government, some powers to the state government. And now you're telling me all of that doesn't matter? Both sides can do both? Congress has the power to arm and presumably disarm the militia, but we can do it. We've got the power to appoint officers, but now you're telling me all these powers are concurrent, so I guess Congress can also appoint officers. And he just ridiculed Madison. And I'm sure Madison thought, well, I'd like to fix that. If that's a problem, I'd like to fix it. And then when he came to write a Bill of Rights, which he basically had to do to save his political career, because Patrick Henry was attempting to destroy Madison's political career after this convention, this gave him an opportunity to fix this problem, whether it was a real problem or an imagined problem by Henry. It had political power. And so he couldn't say the states have the power to arm the militia, because that would have contradicted what the Constitution said. And the states didn't actually arm their militia generally. What they did was simply pass laws that say militiamen will bring weapons with them when called to muster. So here's the Second Amendment again. And now when people hear it after this background, it frequently they have a different understanding of it.
Yeah.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep their arms and not be infringed, the idea being, well, the militia can arm itself. The people can arm itself, and the states will have an armed militia.
And the key word there is security.
Security. There was a motion to change that to defense of the free state, which was defeated. Everybody understood this was about internal security and not defending the country against invasion, because the militia were not up to that.
Isn't it true that in order for Virginia to ratify, Madison had to make the promise for this Second Amendment, for this provision? That was the only way that they would go along with it, right?
I don't know that he made the promise at Richmond. He in his congressional contest against James Madison, James Monroe. He and Monroe ran against each other for congressional seat after Henry had gotten the state legislature to appoint two other people, anti-federalists, to the U.S. Senate. To win that election, Madison promised to write a Bill of Rights. And that's when he made that promise. And when he effectuated that, when he got to the first Congress and wrote the Bill of Rights, this gave him the opportunity to correct this alleged deficiency and to ensure that the South could have an armed militia, regardless of what Congress decided.
Folks, I do want to lift, one of the most salient Madison quotes at that time, 1788. If the country be invaded, a state may go to war. I'm sorry, Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry's quote. If the country be invaded, a state may go to war, but cannot suppress slave insurrections under this new Constitution. If there should happen an insurrection of slaves, the country cannot be said to be invaded. They cannot therefore suppress it without the interposition of Congress. Congress and Congress only can call forth the militia. That was what he felt was the ambiguous language. And, there was a provision, I guess, some conversation about invasion, but Patrick Henry said, well, if slaves revolt, that's not technically an invasion. So there needs to be some level of protection, and that's what they got.
He and George Mason made every argument about a disarmed, enfeebled militia any way they could. The idea that Congress could disarm the militia. At one point, one of them said, suppose the federal government takes Georgia's militia and marches it to New Hampshire. The idea was the same thing. Georgia wouldn't have the militia. What would happen? What would happen without a militia in the state? So he raised many arguments, some of which had merit, some of which probably had no merit. But he was a great orator and awfully skilled at fear-mongering. And the South was just terrified of any interference with their necessary instrument of slave control, the militia.
There was even in chapter six, folks, at the militia war in the South. Madison even wrote at one point, if American Britain should come to a hostile rupture, I'm afraid an insurrection among the slaves may and will be promoted. And I think somewhere I read in other history, you know, Thomas Jefferson, well, I think it was in the Declaration of Independence where, you know, they raised a level of resentment toward Britain for kind of inciting the enslaved.
Yes, I believe that's in the Declaration of Independence.
Yes, I think it is.
Yeah.
Patrick Henry, you write, captured on Virginia's anxiety to drive Virginia further toward the Revolutionary War. People were unlikely to go to war over duties on tea, Henry observed. But, quote, tell them of the robbery of the magazine and that the next step will be to disarm them. And they will then be ready to fly to arms to defend themselves. And obviously, also the fear of insurrections, what Lord Dunmore was saying. And so, folks, this is a very important book. I have been prescribing it to everyone I've come in contact with. I do also think there's a line. You mentioned the patrols. That's where the word patrol comes from. We know that the evolution of the modern day police force began with the militia that was patrolling for us.
Yep.
All right. So literally, folks, so this is the lie. Lastly, Professor Bogus, first let me say this. You mentioned a movie. This is a movie. And you have the book now, man. So I hope you all, well, you know, we don't have any writers anymore because they're on strike. And I support them. But if we ever get that back together, here's the movie, y'all. And what better time to give people a real understanding and context? Because everybody keeps, we have a gun culture. This is just how America is. Why is America this way? Other countries around the world. Oh, that's just the culture of America. But that language doesn't say that. It says for the security, a well-regulated, and even some of the other state constitutions had even more language about regulation. So the people weren't just going buck wild. They could not have contemplated what we're dealing with today. AR-15s, people going in schools, shooting up kids. As bad as they were on slavery, I also don't think they could have ever contemplated the guns being turned inward in this way they are today.
They couldn't. And one of the reasons is the differences in guns. So the most popular gun at the time was the musket. And it was a breech-loaded thing. Single shot, you would fire one shot. And then it took half a minute to reload it with a second shot. So if you had a musket, you could fire one shot in 30 seconds, two shots in a minute. And with modern semi-automatics, and by the way, all modern guns are semi-automatics, whether they're pistols or long guns, if fitted with a standard 30-round magazine, can fire 30 rounds in 30 seconds or less. and then replace that magazine in 2 or 3 seconds with another full magazine and fire another 30 rounds. There is no way that the people at the time of the American founding could conceive of guns being used for mass shootings or mass murders. It was not possible. And it was, as you point out, Reverend Mark, literally inconceivable.
Yeah. Folks, we wanted, again, to talk to Professor Bogus. It's not the first time and it won't be the last time, but to introduce the book to you recently published. We hope you will check it out. We hope you will spread the word. We have to take this head on and push back against the argument. And Professor Bogus, I don't know if it was you or someone else. It might have been you. But in some of your research over the years, it seemed like I read an article you wrote at one point where, and this is important, ladies and gentlemen, there's law scholarship, law review scholarship. And, you know, in law reviews and legal scholarship, I mean, that counts for something. And sometimes law review and law scholarship influences court decisions and rulings and attorney arguments in cases. From the time of from the beginning of law reviews being published, I think in the 1800s to the 1960s, there was never a single one that made an argument that the Second Amendment was right for was a right for an individual to keep and bear arms.
That's correct.
Right. I got that from you, right?
Yes. I'll credit Professor Robert Spitzer at SUNY Cortland. He was the guy who did the original research. I repeated it in, he wrote an article about that, and I repeated it several times, that if there ever had been something settled under constitutional law, it was the Second Amendment, and it was non-controversial in legal circles that the Second Amendment was related to the militia and only gave the people the right to keep and bear arms within the government militia. And all of the federal courts agreed with that, and all of the legal commentators agreed with that until the 1960s. And starting in the 1960s, the NRA began a concerted campaign to attempt to get that changed. But everybody understood that that was how the Second Amendment had been intended and was interpreted.
And the NRA was paying legal scholars.
Yes. Some of the first articles were written by actually their paid staff members, and then some of those people went out and left the NRA staff, but also continued to get grants from the NRA or other groups to do this, to write articles and books.
In closing, Professor, what would you like to see happen in this country with regards to the Second Amendment? I have an extreme view because of the history you shared. I think it's an obsolete amendment for the purposes it was designed for. It's obsolete. We don't need it. This isn't happening anywhere else in the world. Even our original colonizer, you look at all the hegemonic colonial empires in Britain, folks aren't getting shot up every day like the way here. What do you think should happen with the Second Amendment? Should it be repealed? What do we do?
So as a political matter, it's impossible to repeal it. at least in my lifetime, I don't see that happening. I don't think it has to be repealed because it merely needs to be interpreted the way I believe it was originally intended. And the way the Supreme Court had interpreted it prior to 2008, I'm not sure it's completely antiquated because it does provide that a state has some minimum right to an armed militia to provide for its National Guard local emergency, if there are riots, if there is a natural disaster resulting from a hurricane, the governor can call up the National Guard.
Professor, we may have lost you due to the technology. That's probably getting too, and the conversation is probably getting too real. I think we'll see. The professor, we'll give him a moment and see if he's able to rejoin us.
Professor, we may have.
We'll see if he's able to log back on. But folks, again, I hope you will check out this book. In many respects, share it with others. And deal with the importance of it, as a matter of fact. We are dying in this country because of, here we are, there we are, we got it back. Thank you. Thank you for jumping back on, Professor. Like we had a
interrupted there.
That's fine. That's what technology does. But you're right. I mean, it really should be with regard and applied to the National Guard at this point. It makes it useful. Otherwise, it is this other thing and the Scalia's decision and the Heller ruling.
And, you know, and I think if people come to recognize what the true origins of the Second Amendment, there'll be a cultural shift.
Yeah.
And the cultural shift will drive both law and politics.
Right.
Someone once said, if I could write all the songs, I would not care who could write the laws, meaning it's culture that drives everything else.
Right.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Madison's Militia, the hidden history of the Second Amendment, and great information about the characters in this as well. That's why it would make a great movie. Patrick Henry's disdain for James Madison, and that continued. James Madison had a tough time even getting elected. Professor Bogus chronicles that. Madison's Militia, the hidden history of the Second Amendment. That is your summer reading assignment, everybody. Please read it, and you will enjoy it. It's very well written. And it's a gripping account. Professor Carl Bogus, soon to be Professor of Law Emeritus at Roger Williams University. Congratulations on that. Congratulations on the book as well, Professor Bogus. Such an honor as always to have you and to speak with you, okay?
Always wonderful talking with you, Reverend Mark. Thank you.
Thanks for getting woke and listening to Make It Plain. As always, perform an act of kindness on behalf of an elder or young person. Write a letter to a sister or brother who just so happens to find her or himself incarcerated. Offer libations to the ancestors upon whose sturdy shoulders we all now stand. And above all, give thanks to the God of your understanding by whatever name you call her and him. All God asks of us is that we give each other love. Thanks for giving MIP love. And please remember to subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. If all hearts and minds are clear, it has been made plain.